Several years ago in a town in Central Europe, a visitor noted something he couldn't quite figure out. Some of the older townspeople would dip slightly and make the sign of the cross as they passed a certain very ordinary looking wall. He asked why they were doing this, and no one knew except to say, "All I know is that people have been doing it forever." The visitor's curiosity grew so great that he asked permission to chip away some of the layers of whitewash and dirt that covered the wall on condition that he restore it to better than new. And when he did this, underneath the layers, he discovered a beautiful mural of Mary and the child Jesus. It seems that generations before, the townspeople had had this reason to make the sign of the cross, but the picture faded slowly under dirt and grime and was whitewashed finally. But the habit by then was so strong that succeeding generations just kept on doing it. Children would see uncles and aunts doing it, so they thought it was something that ought to be done. They had no idea of the reasons, but familiar things are comforting, so they kept right on going through the motions. I suppose there may be some of this around at Christmas time in America. What began as a church holy day, given meaning by faith, turned slowly into a largely secular holiday with so much sales importance that many small businesses simply admit they couldn't make it except for the boost of the Christmas holidays. Christmas is certainly a secular blessing, but for almost everybody, religious and secular alike, it's a vibrant, colorful time of the year. Lights twinkling, lots of red and gold banners, green wreaths, fragrant Christmas trees, lots of giving of one kind or another, family reunions, good food. The pluses for Christmas are overwhelming. So much so that unless we make a conscious effort, we may overlook those for whom it is not the best time of year. And I can't minister sympathetically to a church without being aware of this. Every psychologist knows that while the majority celebrate, Christmas is often the most depressing time of year for others. O Holy Night becomes for them O Holy Nightmare, because in a family time they have no family, or they have neither the energy nor the cash to keep up with the secular side of the holiday. We have to take that seriously. And I suppose it was a stroke of good luck to find in a newspaper article this week a sentence some of you may have read from a coalition of Protestant and Roman Catholic leaders who insisted, and the rest of this is a quote, insisted on reminding us, even in the midst of celebration, that in the end, the delirium of commercial Christmas devours some, leaves others in ruinous debt, and punishes the poor for whom the joy of Christmas always seems a dollar away. And they are not talking about the lazy poor who are healthy but prefer a handout to working. They're talking about those who work hard, hold two jobs, and still cannot keep up with a season that so passionately celebrates buying. But it isn't only poor or spiritless people who say, as some of my dearest older friends have said to me more than once, "I can hardly wait for the holidays to be over and life to come back to normal." I listen to their reasons. They haven't the appetites they once had for tables groaning with rich food. They are alone, without children. The gathering of kids and grandkids with their cacophony of requests and the mad swirl of shopping satisfy them. These leave them, as the phrase goes, out of the loop. And for such people, it is certainly harder than it was when I was a child, because it lasts so much longer now. Some sharp woman writing in a religious journal I take gave it a special name. Since it starts now, before Halloween, goes through Thanksgiving and Christmas, and ends after New Year's, she calls it Hallowthankmas. In her words, a marathon of card sending, party throwing, putting up and taking down decorations, overeating and overbuying. I suppose unless you take a Christian lifestyle with some seriousness, she will only sound like another holiday party pooper when she points out that all three holidays have pretty much been unmoored, as she puts it, from their religious anchors. Americans during Hallowthankmas remind her of herself, she says, on those vaguely out-of-sorts evenings when she finds herself in front of the refrigerator with a spoon and a carton of ice cream. "I want something," she says. "I'm not sure what, but the ice cream will have to do. It's sweet and comforting and plentiful, and it takes my mind off whatever it is that I really want but don't have." Sometimes in the holiday rush, you've surely felt that way too, that you'd like to find a different center at times for all the celebrating. But the answer is certainly not to try to go back to some austere, purified version of the season. Our Puritan ancestors were the last to try that seriously. Anyone caught preparing to celebrate Christmas in 18th century New England risked punishment under the law. Puritans felt celebrating Christmas was not biblical, and that such celebrations would eventually lead to all manner of mischief. I suppose if some old Puritan Congregationalist preacher were to be reincarnated and go walking around our frenetic malls and go to the less inhibited office parties, he would shout, "I told you so," but we can't pretend that the season doesn't exist, and we don't want to. What we could do, I think, would be to remember that we are a culture within a culture, and that there will be, ought to be, something different about the way we celebrate these days. I rather admire the old rabbi in Greenville, South Carolina, whom I read about in a book called Resident Aliens. The title, by the way, is meant to describe us. The men who wrote the book believe that genuinely Christian people are alien in this society, residing in the midst of it, but refusing to be molded utterly by it, and from time to time passing judgment on it in terms of the world to which they belong. One of them knew this old rabbi who used to challenge the values of the society around him by telling each one of his children, "That's fine for everyone else, but it's not fine for you. You are special. You are different. You are a Jew. You have a different story, a different set of values." He wasn't foolish enough to think he could stop some practices. He just kept saying, "You are special. You have a different set of values." Perhaps it's time for Christians to say the same things to their children, not only in the year's end holiday season, but all year long. I know, of course, even as I say this, how hard it is to strike a balance. Push too hard, and the kids rebel and forsake their roots entirely. I have no brief for the agenda of the Christian far right and its extreme morality, but I also have no brief for an ultra-liberalism that lazily says anything goes, that it's not chic to say something negative about books or films, no matter how violent, no matter how vulgar. If we ourselves are special, if we hold some values higher than those around us, then we ought at times to be able to say to our children, "That may be okay for others, but you have a different story." But I'm also interested this morning in what the title suggests. The whole business of gift giving at Christmas. I mentioned a couple of years ago that we felt so overwhelmed at our house by the expanding family, the new in-laws, the steadily increasing chore, keeping up with all the names and who got what gift and did we forget anybody, and racing around in the crowds from store to store to find things that we all agreed to just buy for the kids while they are kids, and to get together as adults to eat and talk and increase our love for one another without worrying whether Jim will like this shirt or Sean will already have gotten that same sweater from somebody else. We didn't want our convictions to be tainted by the suspicion that maybe we just wanted to save money. So in the names of those we loved and would have bought new clothes for, we gave what we would have spent to people who, unlike our own loved ones, would have had nothing at all otherwise. It has worked well. And it's an idea that seems to be catching on. I just read about a man named Mac Smith, founder of the Environmental Ethics Institute in Florida, who debated what gifts he could give his kids to help them look past the glitz and discover the guts of the Christmas promise. He says, Christmas shopping for me was the most depressing time of year. I don't know which part of me suffered more, my feet or my soul. I liked the idea of giving. I liked the sparkle in children's eyes when they opened presents. I didn't like the idea of what I gave. Things. Manufactured things, many of which wore out quickly, broken often by the end of the first day or week, destined for more shelf life than useful life, one more bit of junk making the rounds, ending up you know where. So, last year, he says, I gave each of my grandchildren two gifts. One gift was a cataract operation. You imagine how the kids liked that. That gave sight to a blind person in Nepal. I made donations for the four operations in my four grandchildren's names. The other gift was something to wear or use, made in a cooperative craft shop in a poor village in a third world country. All my Christmas gifts were purchased from catalogs that support this same kind of giving. My feet never hurt, and my soul felt better. No big gift-wrapped package under the Christmas tree with a card from Grandfather. It was a hard thing to do. I felt like the Grinch who stole Christmas, even though I know I'm not. Christmas was stolen a long time ago. I hope my grandchildren someday will understand I'm trying to give Christmas back to them, not take it away. Well, it probably takes more conviction and passion than most of us can manage to do what Max Smith did, but there are simpler ways, if you need them, to start reclaiming the real spirit of Christmas. The United Methodist Church has a publication which it calls the Alternative Christmas Giving Guide. It suggests that we fill out a cost analysis form to discover how much we spend at Christmas and on what, and then cut those costs by 25% and donate that amount to the poor, sick, hungry, and homeless. It's a start, but it does seem paltry to me. A quarter out of each dollar we spend on our own, whom we provide so well for, all the rest of the year, in the one season devoted to the idea of unselfish and outgoing love, I prefer $1 going out for each $1 staying in. It would mean less for our own families for a day, but maybe Christmas would be a time when less is more if there is love behind the giving. It's strange to me now, but the one Christmas, the only Christmas that really stands out in my mind from all the childhood years was one in the very depth of the Great Depression. Not because I got a dozen things, but because I got only one gift. A gift that came out of a love so great that I actually understood for the first time how much I was cared for and the sacrifice that was made. In an age of abundance, I have watched children rip into their piles of packages in a kind of frenzy. No time to enjoy the thrill of one gift before they were consumed to know what was in the next box. Maybe I'm hopeless, but I really did want them to slow down, to be entranced for a few minutes over a gift, even to have this thought run through their heads, gosh, it took some time and some sacrifice for Mom and Dad, Grandmother, or Uncle Bill to go out among the crowds and get this for me. And then to find a little card that says, instead of a second gift this Christmas, we gave the one you would have gotten to a child who would otherwise have had nothing. We gave it in your name with love, because that's what this season is all about. They wouldn't like it. They wouldn't get the point. Maybe not. Or maybe they would. What if we underestimate the capacity of our children to share beyond the family? What if it were possible, after all, to teach them that getting all one can, in the spirit of much of the advertising they see, is not the spirit of Christmas at all, and that they have a different story to tell about what gives at Christmas? You never know. The homely little proverb points out, you never know until you try. Merry Christmas, beloved church.